Welcome back, guys, to the Enablers podcast.
Welcome back, guys. Nice to see y'all again, virtually.
Welcome back, guys. How are you guys doing?
Right, okay. So I have a question for you two. Have you guys ever seen, like, the best data presented in the most informational graphic ever?
I mean, I deal with data a lot in my work, and nothing was particularly groundbreaking to the point where I would want to quote, hey. But I think the best of data visualizations are now ones with lots of charts, interactive charts, colors.
Yeah.
And it takes you through a journey so that you understand the message quite easily without having to read a lot. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think data is, like, very important to make it in a way that, you, like you said, make it through a journey. That's why they call it how to create a story from a data. So yeah. People are going on courses on data science to actually make that happen. And I find that very intriguing.
I've seen this video. I think it was from a TED Talk. This guy basically had a chart of population against GDP, but also the graph transformed across time, where he had dots representing every different country. And the dots would change in terms of size, depending on the GDP growth and also the population, as he scrolled from like year zero to like now 2000s. So you'll see each country moving around where like China was up and then it went down again. Yeah. And the population grew, but GDP was going down. And then it exploded in the recent years. And then it showed like how certain Southeast Asian countries like Malaysia, Indonesia became like Asian tigers, and then GDP growth fell down. It was quite amazing. That was the only one that I can really remember.
That's actually really cool. That reminds me of this graph. Somebody did a bar chart of the movement of companies increasing in profit. So it started out as, so it's a web company. So Yahoo was dominating in like the 90s, and then suddenly Google started coming up, and then it moved like over time. I think that's really cool. I think data is like really important in our day-to-day life, just to get, not just to make decisions, but just having the information and being aware of what's where, because we can see as, you know, if, like I said, if we go on company by company, we can't see the comparison, how well a company is doing until you get to see all this data that's being presented.
I might just say, I just remembered. There's this clip in How I Met Your Mother, right? I forgot who made the chart, but it's like, bar chart on my favorite pie charts, and here's a pie chart on my favorite bar charts. Anyway, that's the name, but
well, anyway, as I was saying, that's not impressed. As I was saying, my colleague recently shared with me a website about data visualization. Basically, he was talking about digital health and how we nowadays tend to easily sign up for a lot of things without overthinking where our information is going. And so this particular site was showing the amount of data leak that was happening at companies. And when you look at it, it's like quite a lot from early 2000 till now. And even some of the companies that were not reported. So they were just saying like, oh, this company left open this database without any password protected for 30 minutes. So who knows what people are doing with it.
Yeah, it's quite scary. I remember once I had posted something on Reddit. It was something to do with like privacy. And the guy just replied to me. He said he found my data. He said, this is your full name. He had my full name.
Oh my God.
He showed me the area that I was living in. And he pointed out two areas which he thinks I live in. And he also knew my nationality just by like searching things online.
Oh so, my God.
I guess
wait,
my data
this
leaked
is
somewhere.
Through Reddit.
Yeah, I read it. I posted something about, oh, I wanted to post some stuff here, but I'm a bit concerned about security issues, sensitivity issues. And this guy, I'm guessing, is a huge proponent of like, no, you shouldn't do that. Like post stuff online or like try to like divulge any kind of sensitive information online. And he proved his point by putting out, this is your full name. This is where I think you live and you're Malaysian. So I'm like, oh.
But that, and that, he gathered that through your Reddit account, which is supposedly anonymous.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what he's trying to say. Like, there's a lot of things that you can find online if you put just enough effort. And he said he only spent a few minutes just to find that information. So you're right, Karen. Data leak is everywhere. It's just that you're just not aware of it.
That is terrifying.
Yeah. It is really. I think after one of my colleagues shared that that presentation, everyone was like, oh, crap. Because even there was this instance where it's from Strava. People are getting information from Strava. This U.S. Army base was discovered because they were recording their running in, it's in Iraq, that somebody found out where the U.S. Army base, and they used that information. So that's like very crucial. But anyway, so my point was that this particular website is about data visualization. It started out by this British data journalist, David McKendalls. And he's like the guy you want to say about how he emphasized the importance of data and how to present it. He wrote a book on how to use visualization to tell a better story. And I think one part of the website was really, really interesting because it talks about misconceptions about our daily information that we have. So I think Riz went through it and then discovered that dogs don't actually sweat through their mouth. They actually sweat through their paw pads. And I find that very cool. Another misconception that was put out on that website was about the chemical imbalance being the cause of depression. So before reading all this, I've always had this idea that depression is diagnosed by doctors because they've researched it. So that's my assumption. As per any other disease, it is often diagnosed because somebody discovered something. And so it went on and on and on, only to realize actually that's not often the case. So in this particular topic, it goes into the fact of someone creating an idea of why depression occurs and then justifying it and then people accepting it without actually looking into the data or research. And then throughout generation, everyone just assumed that that's the case. So this misconception led to an article that was published, I think, in the early 2000s. And then it reminded me of a book that I've been suggested that was published in 2013, and it's called Cracked by James Davis. So it's a very controversial book, I would say, because it goes into the history of psychiatry and also the issues with pharma companies in making profit by selling drugs. So, okay, depression is not... it's not something to be taken lightly. I think it's a very serious issue, especially nowadays, now that we've seen, you know, the effect of lockdown happening to people and the amount of stress that they're in, and it's just overwhelming. And in fact, there's a statistic in 2013 that showed 1 in 4 people in the UK and US will develop a mental disorder in any given year. But that's the thing. That is what the data is showing us, but what actually happens behind the scene. So when I was reading this book, part of the story was talking about how if you were to be diagnosed with a mental illness from a doctor, you go to another doctor and you suddenly don't get diagnosed with a mental illness. So that goes to show how kind of almost arbitrary medicine can get if there's no clear-cut example of evidence. So like if you break a leg, you go to an x-ray, there's an obvious evidence that, okay, your bone is broken. Whereas in certain stuff, like especially internal organs, some people have different functions. Like people in the higher altitude would always have a lower blood pressure. So when a normal doctor would check their blood pressure, they would think like, oh no, we need to amp up your blood pressure, when in fact their body is accustomed to that and that is how they should function. So yeah. There's a lot of arbitrary in medicine itself. And this goes into how mental illness is being diagnosed and how arbitrary it can get. This book is written not to debunk that mental illness exists, but it's more into emphasizing how pharma industry is using whatever they can to build drugs and then to sell it out for everyone to take, for clinicians to prescribe, and that for the citizens to think that that is the final option for them, and thus increasing the value of the product itself and then giving incentive for the pharma company to keep producing it.
You mentioned two things. One is big pharma being profit-driven and they are quick to push drugs. Second is potential misdiagnosis. But these two are separate. The ones pushing the drugs to those diagnosed are the doctors, right? Mm-hmm. Not the pharmas. The pharmas may try to convince the doctors about the efficacies of these drugs, but the process of diagnosis of depression, if you're clinically depressed, is something that is independent of big pharma companies, or is it not?
There is actually a way of how medicine progresses. So there's always research coming from academia or even pharma company. And a lot of doctors would go to conferences to know about the current issues of another country that might happen to another country. So you get all this information from this research, essentially. That's how clinicians keep up with diseases, per se. And so in one way or another, clinicians can be convinced by pharma company through their research based on the data that they presented. And hence, they then, what happened in pharma is that once they do the research, they then do research on what drug would be beneficial to circumvent this disease that is up and coming. And so in that way, clinicians are convinced to look more to their patients if this is the case, and this could be the drug for it. So in one way or another, everything is interconnected. So saying this, do you think this is all new information to you, or have you already known that doctors, you know, they learn through 8 years of their life, and so they would always know the final say of what to give to patients? Do you always take what clinicians would tell you as a final answer, or do you always, you know how people would always say like, oh, go get a second opinion? Has that not ever occurred to you that maybe everything might be a little bit arbitrary?
I mean, misdiagnosis has happened, not just within the mental health space, even within the more tangible physical health aspect, right? So yeah, I mean, it's not new news that doctors may not diagnose correctly.
So when you say that, it goes to show that, you know, different doctors have different information being given to them, and their exposure of how much they want to know about that particular area. So this book emphasizes on how much pharma industry manipulate the psychiatry field because of how easy they are to justify certain diseases, because the fact that you need to cut open a person's brain to understand, oh, this is different. And then the next week, cut open the brain again, oh, this is different. So whatever information you get is all blood driven. It's all everything within the body itself. But they are pushing this narrative that there's a chemical imbalance in the brain for people to be diagnosed with depression or ADHD specifically. And because of that, there's a lot of diagnoses that happen because they are justifying by the criteria being put out from the initial group of doctors who just spoke words and said, okay, we should diagnose based on this and this and this, and this instead of real hard data.
Just to backtrack and just really summarize for my own personal convenience, you're basically saying that For example, if you have, say, a diabetes issue, there is a physical point of reference in terms of data that you're referring to before you say that, look, you have diabetes. Like there is a number that you're measuring from your blood sugar levels or something and saying, mm-hmm. if you reach this point, then we will deem that you are diabetic. If you're under that number, then we'll say that you're close to becoming diabetic. But from mm-hmm. the consensus that we have among, among a lot of doctors, we don't consider you diabetic just yet. But when it comes to mental illnesses, say depression and anxiety, what the narrative is in terms of what the diagnosis should be is the quote-unquote chemical imbalance that's happening in your brain of the patient, right? But mm-hmm. because that data cannot be measured directly, it's given as a narrative, it's given as a reason to patients who come and say, look, I think I have a mental illness. But because you're not measuring it, it's easily manipulated or used by doctors when it necessarily is not backed by any kind of data.
Yes.
So, which is kind of, I guess it's kind of true. I can agree to a certain extent in the case that when I went to my doctors first in Japan, like they did all the physical checkups and then we figured out it's not a physical issue. And then the doctor said, look, we think you're mentally, you may have a mental issue or a mental health issue. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, oh, we think you might be clinically depressed and anxious. And I guess one is my denial of not wanting to receive such a diagnosis. But looking back, there wasn't really any kind of measurement about, oh, we put this in your brain and then measured it out and looked at it and said, look, you are depressed and anxious because of this number. But rather it's more of conjecture for all the other data that he has. And there's this other book that I'm reading at the moment as well, that this doctor had diagnosed his patient with the same thing. The patient couldn't sleep, he had like panic attacks and he had loss of mood and all the symptoms that is typical of depression and anxiety patients. Mm-hmm. But then the doctor gave the reason and explanation to the patient that, look, we think it might be because of certain chemical imbalances in the body like serotonin. But then the patient asked the doctor again, but how do you know that's the reason for me? You're not, how are you diagnosing that? You're just giving me that reason without actually showing something that you've measured from my own body or brain, which then led the doctor to do other research and stuff, which I think you kind of have kind of a point here, but what do we do with that information and this knowledge that you've just shared with us?
So I think, so basically what I'm trying to get at is that there's a lot of easy diagnosing for depression. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if it's something that you need to make sure that you're not being diagnosed just for the fact that for the doctors to easily write you off and give you medication for it. So I think what I'm saying is that you cannot just take an answer given to you unless there's the clear evidence. So this book basically goes into how pharma is manipulating the medical industry to increase the production of antidepressant. And for doctors to be convinced of giving them freely to their patients, because back then doctors get incentive of the amount of drugs that they give from certain pharma company, and they also get incentive of giving talks to other hospitals to convince them that this drug is to be used for this disease and this is how you should diagnose, and you know, those kind of things. So the connection is very profit driven.
So were these big pharma companies then held accountable for it? Was it deemed to be misconduct?
This is also a thing you can't. So the only reason why this is not becoming a bigger issue is because of how arbitrary this disease is being diagnosed. You cannot say for certain this person doesn't have depression if he or she is feeling low for a certain amount of time and have all the symptoms being written in the book. But at the same time, some of them can end up being like So all these antidepressants. So this book showed that there's a data showing that there's no difference between a person taking placebo pill and a person actually taking this antidepressant from a certain company. And so in essence, if they do feel better when they take the antidepressants, there's a strong chance that those are also placebo effect. So when you have all this kind of thing that you cannot particularly see for certain that this pill doesn't work or this pill doesn't do anything except for just making them feel like they're feeling better, it becomes very complicated to justify, like, look, this pharma company is abusing this line of medicine. And also a lot of people don't want to believe because they bury all this kind of data. So it's not open to public people. Even this guy, when he was doing his research, a lot of the companies or even researchers who are associated with companies turn down the interview. So there's a lot of nuances that are not being picked up. And so that is causing people to be more confident in whatever is being given out because there's no other party to kind of fight to say, like, okay, this is actually a bit suspicious.
Well, yeah, which can be quite dangerous, right? So I'm speaking this out of anecdotes from friends I know who studied psychology, and they've been told by their professors. So this is not backed by proper evidence. But there is a very prominent company in Malaysia which advertise about mental health issues, and if you need help, go to them. And if you drive around like the LDP or a lot of the highways in KL or Klang Valley, you'll see their advertisements around. And there's been a lot of anecdotes that I hear from this company that they are just out there to get patients in, quickly diagnose them, and then just sell antidepressants to them. It's profit-driven, which is kind of dangerous because I've had stories from friends where the mom was having an issue, she was having acute anxiety, she started taking these antidepressants, and as a side effect of it, she started getting hallucinations, which made the whole thing worse. I've also had friends who take antidepressants and had side effects which made them really, really horny at really odd times, like when they're walking with their friends and out of nowhere just become really, really agitated down there. Yeah. And I feel like this is kind of dangerous because the hallucination one is really scary. The horny one is perhaps not such a bad side effect in a way, but it's dangerous because you're putting in these pills, these drugs in your body, which might affect your actual chemical balance when it may not necessarily be in balance to begin with, right? Because if you don't have the proper diagnosis for it, you're not doing a blood test or some kind of test which actually measures the levels of those hormones, then in a way you are intruding, or you're putting something intrusive into your body which may have adverse effects. And that's not a risk that I would advise people to take unless they have all the information, right? There's always like alternative methods out there for dealing with mental health issues. From my own experience, that you can always consider first before taking any kind of drugs. Unless it's really severe and it's a pain that if you don't take it away, it will kind of cause something really bad for you, then maybe go and consider antidepressants. But if not, then maybe you want to take a second opinion or read up a bit more about it before just quickly trying to get a quick pill, a quick fix.
Yeah, I think in general, medicine is always something, it's not the end all for everything. It's not the answer for everything. I think it's always there to help you. Like for example, if you have high blood pressure and then you take this medicine to kind of lower your blood pressure, you shouldn't continue living the lifestyle that you were living, like continuing eating like things that might cause high blood pressure. You change your lifestyle to make it better, to make it manageable. This is another thing, is that during that time when this book was written, the way the doctor are giving the antidepressant so freely, it's just so shocking. And the fact that they managed to convince their patients to say, like, this is all what you need to do, when in fact it could be temporary. You should get patients to use a drug as a temporary measure to wean it off, and so they can continue living their life. Nobody wants to be living with having to take the pill for the rest of their lives. That's just very depressing. And so as per any medicine, I think people just need to understand that you shouldn't take, data is convincing, but you should always take it in a very skeptical way on why a data is like that. Because even when I go to conferences, is if the data looks too good to be true, you start getting a bit skeptical. Whereas if I show this to another person, it's like, okay, this is very convincing. Because a human body is, when you do experiments on human body, you can never get a clear-cut result. It's really rare. It's really hard. Everybody behaves differently. And so this goes to show how important data is, and the fact that we, as citizens ourselves, we need to do our own research on how a certain drug being pushed out or why you are recommending this. I'm not saying don't not trust your doctor, but at the same time, you should do your own research as well.
So yeah, I really like the point that Kyrene brought up about if, let's say, you have issues with high blood sugar, for example, just taking a drug to reduce your blood sugar and then not changing your diet isn't the way to go, because you want a wholesome treatment, right? The same goes for mental health. And I'm quoting something which I heard from a lecture by Dr. Chua Suk Ning. So Dr. Chua came to Malaysia for a talk in one of the halls in Selangor a few years back, and I went for her lecture. She was basically just giving an introductory of what depression and anxiety is, trying to raise the awareness of the whole mental health scene in Malaysia back then. And just to give a bit of background, so we put a bit more credibility for Dr. Chua. So she's the founder of Relate Malaysia. Relate Malaysia is basically a non-profit organization in Malaysia that helps providing like mental health services, education, training, and advocacy. They even provide online therapy for anyone who's interested, especially in this pandemic when you can't really travel. Mm. So do check Relate Malaysia out. She's basically had a PhD in mental health psychology, and she's currently actually a visiting scholar at Harvard HD School of Public Health. So she's very credible. She's very educated and authorities in terms of advising for mental health. And one of the takeaway messages that I got from attending her lecture is that drugs, all these antidepressants, things for solving your mental health issues, may be a solution, but it's not something that a lot of qualified psychologists would immediately prescribe for you. It's always something that is given to people who have acute, extreme mental health issues, and also usually given as a last resort for people who has had chronic issues for a very long time and there's nothing that can really help them. A lot of the treatment is usually going for therapy. And in therapy, it's really trying to sort out your issues by first discovering, were there any struggles, stresses, mental stresses that you faced recently, which is first causing this mental health issue? And there's this thing called CBT. So CBT is cognitive behavior therapy. In a way, just like how we talked about changing your diet, changing your exercise, etc., for physical health issues, CBT is that change of diet, that change of behavior for your brain, for your mental health. It's changing your behavior for your cognitive function. It's where if you get into the motion of being really negative, self-critical, very harshly self-critical for yourself, and it makes you spiral down into this like deep dark hole in your brain, cognitive behavior therapy is there to help train you to not spiral down so much. It tries to train you and change your thinking behavior, which is what a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists would first suggest and try to train their patients to get into first to deal with their mental health issues. So yeah, I thought I just mentioned that. So Dr. Chua Suk Ning from Relate Malaysia.
So mental illness is real. It is something that is very serious, but at the same time, there's not a lot of research that goes into understanding about what happens in the brain, because you can't really study that.
So after all that's been said, are we actually convinced now that chemical imbalances do not contribute to depression? Because I don't see an alternative reasoning for it. And what we fail to acknowledge is the efficacies of some of these drugs in treating and managing clinical depression, because we've disputed the use and the application for certain people who don't actually need it and the misdiagnosis. But what about the case where people have actually come forward and said it's actually helpful? And it has got me out through times when I was hitting myself and I was in this downward spiral. I just want to know that for the person who contributed literature to disputing this myth or this concept, what then is the reasonable explanation if we have? And also counterbalancing that against the benefits of these drugs.
So as far as my knowledge that I have from my reading, I think it's okay. So basically your question is you need to also consider that there are people who obviously need it because they are actually maybe schizophrenic or, you know, the type that there is evidence to be diagnosed per se. Mm-hmm. But then a lot of the diagnosis that happened is because the doctor took an easy way to just give out the antidepressants. And most of them, if not all, don't necessarily need them. But in a way, because it's a mental health issue, you could also think about the fact that they themselves physically needed something to help them when in fact they don't. But because they put it in their mind that this is going to help them, they have this this mindset to say, this medication helped me despite all the side effects that I'm having. But there's actually figures in that book that showed that there's evidence of the percentage of... So even figuring this out is actually quite arbitrary. The percentage of mood is done via survey. Oh, do you feel better today? Or do you feel better tomorrow? And when they compare that between people taking the drug, people actually doing psychotherapy, and people actually doing placebo, and then no treatment, they're all quite similar in terms of the response. But then again, like I said, these are all measured in a survey, not an evidence from a medical equipment to test out something.
It's subjective, basically, you're saying, right?
It is subjective. So everything is quite subjective. But I still think your mind plays a very strong role in healing your body. So when you already have a set point that this drug is going to help you, chances are it will, unless you find there's no evidence of it. I mean, is there an evidence for when you are involved in something, but then you decided to change the way you think about it, and then you looked at it in a different way?
Sorry, I would err on the side of this of caution with what you're alluding, because you are moving towards a snap out of it solution to mental illness, I feel, because it's all a perspective.
No.
It's all a mental purview.
I'm not. So that's not my conclusion. I'm just saying this particular study is showing that not everyone should be taking the medication. These are all the people that potentially being dished out with this drug. Chances are they don't necessarily need the drug at all. It's just, it's an easy way out for them to have an answer that this is what I have. And so when you already have a diagnosis, it helped people to calm down a lot rather than having to be in this cycle of like, don't know what's going on with me. Like there's something happening. When you get an answer like, oh, I have depression. And then it's something that you can work on. It's all in the mind in that sense. But I'm not saying depression is a myth and that it's everyone are not being diagnosed for it. I'm just saying that during this study that it happened, there were a lot of misdiagnosed because it's easier.
I just want to caveat that whatever Karin said is true in regards of testing, because you always have a big sample of people, and some of which may not have a proper mental illness. So for those who may not necessarily be clinically depressed, what they need is just hope and this notion of belief that something can help you make you feel better. And when you take it, you will, therefore. And it's kind of like how placebo effects work, right? kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But in no way are we trying to dismiss that mental health is a genuine concern. Like, I know for some people who have gone through mental illnesses, just telling them to change their view of the world and have a more positive outlook in life is not the most tolerant advice that you could give to a person who's going through it, because it's more complex than that. Some of us may speak from a position of privilege, not having to go through such a difficult experience. But I think we just need to be mindful of how we also communicate with people who express mental health issues or mental health difficulties.
Yeah, because it's something that you cannot see, right? So it's also a bit difficult in how to maneuver around that as well.
This might not be necessarily related to our discussion here, but I just wanted to point out, because Megat said something about, oh, some people just come up to you and I think they come from a place of ignorance that they don't know any better, that they just tell you like, oh, you just need to be happy and just cheer up. I do think it's ignorant, as in they don't know any better, which is why they feel like that's the appropriate thing to say. But if you're listening to this podcast, I think being understanding, being a listening ear to what your friend who's going through these issues have to say about their problems is better than just putting a very simplistic advice out there, like, cheer up.
I think it's also something around to understand is that the way you deal with things might not be the same as the way other people deal with things. Mm-hmm. So when you listen to these people talking about their issues, don't give your two cents in how you deal with it. Just actually hear them out and then go through the thought process and then get them to realize what they need to do. I think that's like a very hard thing to do, but I think that's probably one of the best way rather than you telling them about what you need to do.
Yeah, I think that's true. When people come to you with a problem, they never really want a solution.
I do.
This is why I only laugh when you tell me your problems.
Mm-hmm. Also, like, yeah, don't laugh.
Don't be telling me what I need to be doing. I know what I need to do. Or sometimes the problem comes with no solution, so I'm just going to wallow in the doom that we are in.
You are in.
In our inevitable doom.
This is why,
like, the state of Malaysia right now. Okay, take that out.
Sensitive, bro.
Sensitive.
Oh, putting aside, I don't know if you guys want to put this in. Did you see that video? I'm not sure if it's Instagram or TikTok or Twitter, but this guy said that he was stopped by police in Malaysia. And he said he was on his way to see his therapist. And then the police said something like, oh, stress dengan PKP ke? As saying, like, jokingly.
Like, oh, gosh.
Shrugging it off, belittling his excuse, basically, or his reason.
Where was he going again? Sorry?
To see a therapist.
He was going to see his therapist.
Okay, therapist. Okay.
Yeah. Have you guys seen that video?
No.
Yeah, no. You guys should watch that video. He's basically going to his therapist because he's having mental health issues because of the PKP. And then, well... untimely, the police is like, oh, tengah stress ke? Kau PKP ke? Like, oh, like belittling the fact that he's going to a therapist. Which...
not surprising. I've read some terrible article regarding police detention sentence. Even for females. Yeah, like, it's horrific. It was on Facebook. Don't know how far it's true. I don't think it's an article written to slander, given her ability to write in purely graphic language.
Also, going back to what Riz has said, I think this goes back into how important to know when to deliver your sarcasm. This is always has been a very fine line with people, because I remember I got butt hurt by a lot of times until I realized I just need to brush it off. But some people don't have that capacity because they have a really genuinely soft heart. So especially when you're in a down low and somebody made a very snarky comment, you're just like, no, mate, no.
You know what they call
like
our
most
generation,
Malaysians,
right?
Now. You know, generation butt hurt.
No, yeah, snowflake generation.
Oh, snowflake.
Snowflake, too gentle, too brittle. can't take any toughness.
Yeah. So I was reading somewhere about...
Can't take a joke.
So Joe Delaney, you know the guy? Shred Bundy. Cool. So one of the fitness people in the UK, one of those fitness person, like super shredded.
Sounds very familiar, but anyway.
Joe Delaney, he's very stoic, but super funny. I watch his videos.
What is that dance description?
But anyway, so he was saying that people need to be less reactive to the things that they don't like in terms and not get triggered by reading things on Twitter that is against what you believe. Scroll past it if you don't like it, but don't waste your energy reacting so badly towards it. Because if you do most of the time, then you're not fit for social media. You should get off it because it's not good for your mental health. That said, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want because like whether you hate it or not, not my problem.
Yeah, but like, okay, this is, I can understand the both sides, how people need to be stronger in taking those type of things. But then you could also say that some people grew up in a family where this is not a norm. Sarcasm is not a norm. For them, whatever they take is like face value. So if somebody is saying, you know, even like a jokey sarcasm, they probably wouldn't get it. So it can be a bit difficult because everybody has a different type of value. If you go to a certain community, they probably don't understand what sarcasm is. I come to the UK like, bloody hell, sarcasm is left, right, front, and center.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that when you treat others, when you can, be empathetic and compassionate. But at the same time, you as for your personal growth, should learn to be more tough because the world is tough and other people will not necessarily be compassionate to you all the time. Well, most times they will not be. And Karin's pointing at my guy.
What, you see, I'm not tough?
Eh? Oh, no,
not
never.
Compassionate.
Not compassionate. Oh, not compassionate. That sounds
dengar
about
boleh
right.
Tak?
Sorry, I was on my phone.
My phone lah dah.
Sounds about right. Not compassionate. Yeah, can be heartless.
I'm like, can be heartless too.
Yeah, I couldn't. I remember like when I started going to Japan and started living alone and meeting people, you know, starting to work. I couldn't really handle criticism. I felt like I could have been tougher. Like,
but you're only just learning.
No, that's the thing because I think growing up, I've always been treated very well by others. I've not really faced any kind of very little opposition or like people. Criticizing me and stuff, so she made me kind of soft, which growing up I feel like that's a good skill to have.
Yeah, that's actually true. Yeah. Be tough internally and externally. Okay, I think we covered like quite various different things and how everything is interrelated to each other, like from data to pharma to medicine to pills. I appreciate that some of them we might have glossed over instead of actually going into it, but at the same time I think it's just putting an awareness out there that you know, as per any information that you get from the media, never trust it as your sole source. It's something that you have to also do research in. There's always little caveats of what they're hiding because anything that the media puts out is curated, right?
Yep.
So in a way, it's good to be questioning those things and read more.
Specifically for everyone out there listening, if you are personally going through a tough time as well, going through some depressive moments and need to reach out to people, speak to someone, because right now in Malaysia, we've seen an increase in the number of anxiety cases of people acting on their depression as a result of losing their jobs, being evicted for not being able to pay rent, etc. So that's obviously not good news because one case leads to another and it kind of like is a domino, which is why as well, we see a movement of people discouraging discussion or popularization of these news because it may create a domino effect that is undesirable. So speak out to someone and try and get that address as opposed to just keeping it to yourself.
For anyone in Malaysia, if you guys are considering therapy, do check out Relate Malaysia. I know they have online therapy sessions. And till the next episode, take care. And if you guys have any comments or questions, do tweet us at The Enablers Pod or on our Instagram at The Enablers Pod as well.
Till then, see you guys in the next episode.
See ya.
Bye.